So, we come on to the, in a way, most interesting, most challenging part of the topic, and the one that I haven't written yet. So I've no idea how to approach this. And it's part of the spirit of the thing that I've not tried to work it out. That's my excuse. I've talked about imagination as a faculty that we have, that is natural to us, but that requires conscious activation, conscious feeding and exercise, to use a rather strange metaphor. And that once it really flourishes, becomes who we are, becomes the mind. I've talked about it as functioning within the field of sensitivity to life, a responsiveness to life, empathy for life, especially for the natural world, or rather beginning with an empathy for the natural world, a feeling of identity with the natural world, which senses it as alive, and, you know, traditionally in earlier societies would have resulted in the peopling of the natural world. That functions, of course, as ethics. Once it's flourishing, it leads to a sensitivity that cannot harm living beings. Even cannot damage the world. So that's, yes, the first and perhaps, in a sense, most basic, most characteristic mode of functioning of the imagination. Then there's the functioning of the imagination in terms of a responsiveness to the aesthetic, to the aesthetically pleasing, and especially the aesthetically pleasing that communicates or conveys values in the form of beauty, to use that as a compendious term. So we talked about it in those two contexts. But what I want to try to explore this morning is the imagination functioning as the vehicle for illumination, the vehicle for insight. It is what sees the truth. It is what sees reality. It's our minds functioning in a way that it allows them to absorb the true nature of things. So how on earth to find my way into this topic? I'll just stumble around a bit, and no doubt something will come. So first of all, maybe I should go back to this distinction that Bhante makes between the image and the illumined image. So we're very familiar with the idea of deep archetypes. You know, this is an idea that Jung made commonplace, you might almost say, that was generally understood within Western culture, that images in all cultures express deep patterns within the human mind. So you see the same archetypes occurring again and again. You know the sort of theme, the archetype of the wise old man, or the anima or the animus, and so on, the shadow. So you see these embodiments in different cultures manifesting in quite different ways, but which touch on something that is, Jung said, collective, the collective unconscious. Something that belongs to us as human beings, not as members of a particular culture. So you'll get the same themes occurring again and again. You get the devil in Christianity. You get you get Mara in Buddhism. Of course, they're quite different, but the images belong to the same sort of archetypal stable. How they're interpreted makes all the difference. So yes, we're quite familiar with that. We're familiar with the fact that in our dreams, images may occur that are more than personal. You sometimes wake up in the morning and there's an image in your mind that impresses itself upon you as something completely sort of beyond your normal understanding. You can't explain it in terms of the events of the day or of your past or whatever. It's not what I call a card indexing dream. You know, a lot of dreams are to do with sort of categorizing things and putting them away. It's something more than that. It's something that seems to emerge from, one wants to say, a deeper level, to use that metaphor. And that often you have that sort of dream and the image emerges and you really want to do something about it. So, you know, consequently you bore people telling them about it because other people's dreams are never as fascinating as your own unless you can communicate them in a really living way. But there's something in it that you really don't want to lose and that you want to stay with. So we're sort of reasonably familiar with this idea. And sometimes also you'll see an image that impresses itself very powerfully upon you and kind of won't go away. Maybe a visual image, it may be a sound, it may be a set of words or whatever, but they impact upon you at a level beyond you as an ordinary person, if you see what I mean, as an ordinary conscious identity. We're reasonably familiar with this idea, I think. And it's interesting, in the early days of the FWBO, I don't think there's anybody here who was around at that time, so I can say whatever I like about it. Even Padmasuri wasn't.
I've heard a lot about it.
I've heard a lot about it. We used to have dream groups, Marmaki, who was very interested in Jungian analytical psychology and became a Jungian analyst. She led groups with us in which we would meet together to explore our dreams. And it was a very, very striking sort of interaction that we had through those dreams, all rather young. We tended to end up a bit smashed, but that's another question, after Marmaki had gone, of course. They're very exciting times, those, the early days of the FWBO, with a strong sense of exploring these kind of dimensions, the dimension of the archetypes, the unconscious, the mysterious world beyond our self-identity. So we're quite familiar, perhaps, with that sort of realm, the idea that images can be very, very powerful, can be very deep, can express something about the nature of things that is really quite profound. Funny enough, I saw a Fistful of Dollars the other day. I hadn't seen it when it sort of first came out. And, you know, besides the appeal of To My Machismo, I realised that it was really quite a profound film. I watched then a few dollars more and I thought it was rubbish. It was just sort of playing on, they'd struck an archetype in the first film and they just sort of made money out of it, so they wanted to do more. The first film, Clint Eastwood manages to communicate a sort of God, something that's not really explicable. You don't know where he's come from, you don't know what's motivating him, you don't know where he goes. He's just sort of impersonal force of justice. Administering justice in the roughest and almost coldest way, like a god. And I thought it was a remarkable film because it struck this sort of godlike depth that he became for a while something inexplicable in human terms and that, sort of terrifying the impersonal force of cosmic justice. I don't know whether you'll agree with me. But I resisted seeing it in the past, but I just happened to see it, and I was very deeply struck indeed, surprised myself. So the point I'm making is that film touched on some deep, deep archetypal theme. Perhaps the best of films do that. They manage to strike on something really deep in who we are, well, almost beyond who we are. I think that's what the best of art and literature does. It takes us beyond our ordinary identity. But that's not necessarily illumined. I don't think Clint Eastwood represented illumination. I think it represented a deep, deep force of nature, you could say, of reality. But I don't think it represented illumination. Something else would have been needed for that. Something perhaps rather hard for Sergio Leone to do. So it's important to distinguish between images and illumined images. Because what can happen is that one starts to feel that because something is powerful and moving, that it is therefore illumined. This was a topic that I found very interesting in talking with Bhante, because he was discussing the whole question of Tantra and discussing whether new order members should be encouraged or allowed, or even old order members allowed, that's not the right term, encouraged to visualize wrathful figures and what he called demonic figures, especially those with animal heads and so forth. And he said that his sense was that although's because they're mine rather than his. He said that he thought that the atmosphere of Tantra was really quite far from the Buddha, and that he was doubtful whether it was a means of communicating illumination. Now, I'd put a few codicils to that. I'd say that... Well, in a sense, any image can become an illumined image. So it's not that they could not communicate illumination. But the issue is whether they readily communicated. We'll come back to that. Anyway, the point I wanted to make was that, well, some people feel very powerfully moved by this image or that image, this wrathful image or that, demon-headed, bull-headed, or whatever image, it impresses itself very strongly upon them. And what Bhante seemed to be saying was, well, the fact that it impresses itself upon them does not mean that it is a vehicle for illumination. Many, many images may impress themselves upon us. They may overwhelm us. We may be overtaken by gods. It's possible to be possessed by a god. That's what oracular prophecy is all about, isn't it? That you are taken over. The Pythia was taken over by Apollo. You see it a lot in Indian popular culture. People get taken over by gods, and they speak with the tongues of the gods. It's clearly something of a far more than human nature is going on. But it's not necessarily collected with illumination. So I'm not saying that what I understand is not that Bhante was saying that these images cannot communicate illumination, but they do not readily do so, and the fact that they impress themselves upon you does not mean that they're suitable objects for contemplation, for gaining access to illumination. He seemed to be saying that... The tantric phase of the development of Buddhism, which of course is a rather compendious term for a multiplicity of different developments, became further and further removed from the central spirit of Buddhism. So I've wandered. I'll carry on wandering down this line because I think I'm getting my point. So we want to distinguish between the image and the illumined image. But we also want to distinguish between the image, the illumined image. We want to distinguish between the illumination of images, because presumably all the Buddha perceives the whole world as illumined. All images are for him illumined images. That's the significance of Varochana. Wherever he looks, he sees illumination. Whatever he sees is illumined. Anything, any object, any image in the mind, any thought becomes illumined in the mind of those who are illumined. But some images are, as it were, easier gateways to illumination than others. This is what Bhante's arguing, I think, is what the sense that I make of what he's saying, remembering what he said, particularly in Tuscany in 1981, in some of the small groups we had. For instance, I asked him, could you take the image of Apollo, an image that had appealed to me very strongly, and by contemplating that, gain illumination? Bhante said, yes, you could. Of course you could. But it would take a very long time. And he made it clear what he meant by a very long time was perhaps many lifetimes. It's as if certain images become, perhaps by their very nature, are, as it were, closer to illumination, and by their context are gateways to illumination. And so part of the art that we're engaged in is of discovering the images that are more capable of illumination than others. All images are capable of illumination. There's no doubt about that. But some images provoke illumination. So what we do in practice is we put ourselves in contact with the images that are most likely to provoke, to use that metaphor, illumination in us. Yes, you could sit and contemplate anything. But the art of imaginative development, the imagination jhana, you could say, the art of imagination in the context of Dhamma, is trying to find those images that really convey illumination, so that by your contemplation of them, you're both absorbed into them in the deepest possible imaginative way, and illumined by them, because through them shines something from, as it were, beyond them. So that really is the question that we face. How to find the images that will both connect with our own imaginative life, both personally and culturally, that those images that are most capable of carrying illumination to us, if you see what I mean. The image stands between us and illumination in this metaphor. So we need to find the images that are most transparent to the illumination of reality, of enlightenment itself. Does that communicate? Have you got what I mean? So, that's quite clear. I might try and write that down. Bhante's saying that he thinks that we've inherited this whole tradition, starting with the Buddha himself, running right the way through to modern Buddhist traditions that are continuous with those ancient traditions. But we start in a completely different cultural context, a radically different cultural context. There's probably never been such a major break in continuity as we are in the middle of now. We are radically separated from even our own traditional culture, let alone the traditional cultures that Buddhism grew up in. So we're doubly removed. We're removed by, as it were, geographical cultural separation, but we're removed also by economic, political, social, cultural developments which separate us from those traditional perspectives. So we've sort of got to start anew. But at the same time, we need to draw on and be inspired by and influenced by the developments that have taken place throughout Buddhist history. Some such useful, powerful material there. So the issue that we face as Western Buddhists, and in a way as Indian Buddhists, the issue is faced in the same issue is faced from a slightly different point of view. How do we, from our own present culture, come into relationship with the Buddha, with enlightenment, with Bodhi, under the inspiration, the guidance of the Buddhist tradition? Now, Bhante says that he thinks that we can sort of broadly categorize our approaches to the different phases. So he says, first of all, that clearly the Buddha is the central inspiration, the central focus. I'll say much more about this later, but he's the one we look to both as the embodiment of enlightenment and as the teacher of the basic Dharma. And he argues that what we find in the suttas and in the agamas, to the extent that we're able to get access to them, not nearly enough has been translated from the other early texts. I think it's a great shame. Partly because it reinforces what we find in the Nikayas, but partly because it also has some slightly different material. And there's also an interesting examination of what not in one or the other, because that tends to reveal something more fundamental. I mean, with the Satipatthana Sutta, I find that really interesting, that we've got five different versions or so. And what they have in common is, in a way, suggests that is most important about it. So, yeah, just as a side issue. I don't think we should just confine ourselves to the Pali. The problem is that's most available to us, and this probably contains what we need. So Bhante says that is the touchstone of Buddhist doctrine and practice, that we're quite free to take from and learn from later traditions, but we must be able to touch them, test them on the basis of what's found in what we know to be, or what we know is near to being, what the Buddha taught. We must be able to say, is this consistent with what the Buddha taught? Is it consistent with what we find in the Nikayas? Of course, that's a complex question, because some of what's in the Nikayas is clearly later, but you know what I mean. The meaning of orthodoxy in Buddhism, which I think is required reading. Of course, everybody's read it. It's a very, very important work for understanding Bhante's approach and the founding principles of the movement. So yes, we need to touch down our teachings, our practices, new developments. They're all permissible, but how do they relate to and how do they stand up to the light of the Buddha's own teaching, so far as we know it? So yes, Bhante sees the earliest phase as the touchstone. He sees the Buddha as the central figure. I'm ultimately going to say that the central image of Buddhism. But of course, the early tradition didn't complete or close Dhamma. There were certain areas of Dhamma that were not explored very fully. There needed to be cultural adaptations as Buddhism unfolded. New issues arose, and so on. And Bhante says that he thinks in later developments, in the Mahayana, What we have is really an exploration of the imaginative and devotional richness and depth of the Dhamma in a way that you don't get in the early suttas. It's there, but it's not explored and expressed in so much richness and fullness and variety. So he thinks that, yes, our touchstone is the Buddha. Our basic Dhamma is in the early canon. But that we can gain great inspiration from the imaginative life or imaginative expression of the Mahayana. It's not merely the images, but what I call imaginative philosophy or poetic philosophy. Of course, we have to approach that with great care and not over literalize it. But in the Mahayana, there's ways of looking at things that, as long as we understand them metaphorically, can communicate something about the way things are, something about the content of enlightenment. So Bhante says that the early tradition is very, very good on the clarification of what is knowable, as I was saying yesterday. It's very good on the clarification of right view. It's very good on the path, but it doesn't really give you much content to enlightenment. It doesn't give much food for the imagination to explore what enlightenment is, the content of Bodhi. So Bhante says that in a way what you get is the image of the Buddha is, for early Buddhism, clearly enough. Early Buddhists clearly felt the Buddha embodied enlightenment for them. But gradually people, well, you could say they needed to, or they just naturally began to explore more deeply what enlightenment meant. And they explored it in the way, the only way one can explore it, which is through the imagination. You can't explore it much in words, in concepts. You can only explore the limits of what you can say about it. So gradually, a rich, imaginative, metaphorical language evolved to explore what enlightenment is, so that you could gain some deeper connection with it from a variety of many different angles. And Bhante says that this is the main contribution of the Mahayana, and one that we should allow ourselves to be inspired by. Not dictated to by, if you see what I mean. It's not that we need to adopt the Mahayana, but that the images that evolve in the Mahayana can be a provocation to our own imaginative response. So we shouldn't be limited by them, but at the same time we shouldn't neglect them. He did say, by the way, that of course Mahayana has important contributions to doctrine, and I think you could say the principal development there is Shunyata theory, so long as that is located firmly within the original teaching, which is the way that Nagarjuna and so forth saw it. So, you know, in Mahayana you also get some useful amplification of basic Buddhist doctrine. But the main contribution of Mahayana is this richness of imaginative exploration of the content of the enlightenment experience, of that dimension, of what illumination is. So it provides us with a multiplicity of images that are readily illuminable, if you see what I mean. It provides us with much material for samayasattva, contemplation, which easily is accessible to jnanasattva, illumination. He then considers, as I've said, that Tantra in the more sort of strictly technical sense, he thinks, goes one step too far. It begins to become over caught up with the image, the archetype, rather than the illumined archetype. No doubt, as I said, that it may be that for some that is a useful food for illumination. I can't comment. But yes, he thinks that the whole atmosphere of it is not really Buddhist. He's not trying to justify it on historical grounds or anything like that. His point of view is not trying to justify it on historical grounds, but yes, he sort of put it more like it just, to him, did not feel like Buddhism. It's a complex question and a provocative one, but worth contemplating. Yes, his point of view is that we need to find images that will resonate with us personally, and therefore are likely to become shared and to resonate culturally, which at the same time are strongly connected with illumination. He says that he thinks that one of the problems in developed Buddhism is it became increasingly imaginatively disconnected from the historical Buddha. And he thinks that one of the things that we need to be cautious about is the extent to which later tradition and those traditions that live today have downgraded the position of the historical Buddha and elevated the position of archetypal Buddhas. Amongst Chinese Buddhists that I've encountered, Amitabha is far, far more important than Shakyamuni. And you see the similar thing amongst many Tibetan Buddhists, either Padmasambhava or the great archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas will be much more important than Shakyamuni. And you know where Shakyamuni eventually becomes a manifestation of Padmasambhava. So Bhante says that whilst this may be okay in that cultural context, what he has observed is that it often means that the image floats free from illumination. If you see what I mean. So it becomes an image in its own right. And I was very, very struck. I as it happens, had a very strong dream in which Bhante was telling me that the whole order had to do the golden Yamantaka practice. notwithstanding what he then said to me last week. But the strange thing is, at the moment that I had that dream, my mobile phone went, and it was Yashosaga on the phone telling me that Bodhisaki and Sudarshan had been killed. And Yamantaka is the destroyer of death. Anyway, conqueror of death. Anyway, be that as it may, clearly something archetypal went on there. I then sort of wanted to know more about Yamantaka. I don't know anything about it. So I went online, and I found loads and loads of sites, some of them which were, you know, Yamantaka.com sort of thing. And the weird thing was, you know, I was sort of getting involved in these, yeah, that's interesting. I suddenly realised it wasn't anything to do with Buddhism. And I did find some sites. I found one that you could get an internet initiation into Yamantaka. But what I find really striking, and the internet is so interesting from that point of view because it reveals what's really going on, that Buddhist images are just used as archetypes. They're just used as images which have completely floated free from any illumined mooring, as it were. So the further you get from the Buddha, the easier it is for the image to become mere archetype. Very powerful, very important, but not a conveyor of illumination. That doesn't mean it can't be, but it means it's easy for it not to be. It impresses itself very powerfully on you, perhaps, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a communicator of illumination. So he says that he thinks it's very important indeed that all the images are, as it were, anchored in Shakyamuni, so that you see them all primarily as expressions of his Bodhi. Of course, his Bodhi is not his Bodhi. It's Bodhi itself. But our sort of entry point to it is through him. We know about Manjushri because of Shakyamuni. We know about the wisdom aspect of Bodhi because of Shakyamuni. And he thinks that one of the problems with the historical Buddhism is that sense of of continuity with the historical Buddha has been neglected or lost, perhaps not even valued in many cases, and that all our images of are most easily going to remain vehicles or portals to illumination as long as they are firmly located, as it were, in relation to Shakyamuni. Now, it doesn't mean that you need to sort of think that every time, as it were. In a way, in our movement, we probably, by and large, do that quite naturally and normally. Although I do hear things that make me think that some of us are actually inheriting these dislocated images. But we need to have a sense that what we're exploring when we're exploring the archetypal Buddhism Bodhisattvas, we're exploring deeper into what Shakyamuni gave us access to. If we can keep that sense, they retain a much readier illuminability. Go on, nicely put. It's much easier to keep them connected with Bodhi and not merely deep, powerful human archetypes or archetypes of humanity, collective unconscious. So Bhante said that he'd recently asked Aloka to paint a picture of Shakyamuni with an aura in which the different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas were sort of merging and demerging. Is that right? Yeah, emerging and merging. That's better. So that, you know, you'd see the form of Manjushri sort of appearing within the aura of Shakyamuni, and you know, Avalokiteshvara sort of merging back, and that they're sort of floating in and out. And this is the sort of thing that Aloka can do very, very well. But he wanted that embodied as a sort of iconographic representation of what he thinks the imaginative position is, that our imaginations are accessible to illumination most readily, you can't say exclusively, but most readily when they're connected with the image of Shakyamuni, directly or indirectly. When we retain a sense that all of this glory, all of this richness, comes to us through the Bodhi that we've connected with in Shakyamuni. So he said that he would really favour most order members starting with Shakyamuni. You can't say that he's ordering it, as it were, but he'd prefer people to start with a stronger, deeper connection with the historical Buddha. Of course, when you say with the historical Buddha, in a way that's a bit misleading, because he cannot for us be, you can't have a direct connection with the historical figure, if you see what I mean. What you're bound to be connecting with is already an archetypicalization of a historical figure, a figure that arises from history. So, whatever, you know, if I see the Buddha, and I do, you know, is idealized. It naturally is idealized in my imagination. But he would favour. He's not saying, as it were, that everybody has to, and he's acknowledging that some may naturally start somewhere else. But yes, he would favour that people have focus upon a strong connection with Shakyamuni, because that then really anchors the unfoldment of their imaginations and makes it more readily accessible to the illumination that Shakyamuni has introduced us to. We know of illumination in all its richness. We know of all those Buddhas and Bodhisattvas as expressions of what Shakyamuni discovered and realized. And we can anchor it in the very clear delineation of what is not Dhamma. I think this is almost as important as knowing what it is. I think we need to know on the conceptual level the limits of thought and the faults of thought, as it were. We need to understand Pratityasamuppada. On the imaginative level, we need to connect with these rich, rich images. But the two need to go side by side. I'm fascinated meeting Gelug monks and nuns, in fact, one studying for the Geshe course. And, I mean, it goes way too far, but it illustrates a point. They're not allowed to meditate until they've got to a certain stage in the Geshe course, until they can establish shunyata. I mean, it's way over the top. But what they're basically arguing is that until you've got right view, meditation is dangerous. You know, for the Brahmajala Sutta reasons, that because meditation can so easily lead to experiences that then are badly rationalized, badly theologized, and that lead to a literalization of the experience itself. You can literalize in two ways. You can literalize it in terms of what it is that you're experiencing, and you can literalize it in terms of what you've experienced. So you get the literalization that was God, that was this, that was that, that was shunyata, that was this dhyana, that dhyana. And you get the literalization in terms of the experiencer, I've attained this, I've attained that. The Gelugs were saying that, yes, you need to establish shunyata first. You need to go through this very, very intense and fine prasangika training so that you can, chopper, as it were. I was sitting with them in a little group discussing things, and they said to me, you meditate, don't you? And, I was unaware and said, oh, yeah, yeah. You know, and he said, how do you establish shunyata? and then how do you know that you're making any progress? I was on familiar ground then, so I appealed to ethics, if you see what I mean, which that seemed to satisfy them. It must have been in their book, I don't know. It's very, very interesting. It was a hot, very interesting encounter in general. One of the things that really impressed me was they're very, very friendly and very good relations amongst them, the nuns as well, who were doing the first ones to do a Geshe course, and a very strong communication between them. Quite punchy, but very good-natured. So I commented on it, and they said it was the takse, it was the debate. You have to sit there and defend a position. And they said that in the debate, it's no holds barred. I'd always thought it was all very formal. They said, oh, no. You know, people can say really bad things to you. So I said, oh, you know, like what? And they said, well, your mother is a... So you think they're going, you know, you're off the middle way there, but actually they're telling you are the son of a goat. And then you say, you know, afterwards you have to go away and have a cup of tea together. Anyway, it goes way too far, but I think there has to be a close connection between the image And the understanding of Pratityasamuppada, the understanding of the middle way, the understanding of Shunyata, the understanding of the Lakshanas, they have to be closely connected so that that way illumination can take place and not merely a very powerful experience. A very powerful experience is not necessarily an illumined experience, if you see what I mean. So Bhante went far further than I was expecting him to, and he said that he thinks that, of course, if people are happy doing what they're doing, that's fine. He's not arguing that anybody should stop anything. But he would like us to much more decisively move away from the structure and even the forms that we use for our stage of spiritual rebirth. And he would like us to start exploring. And, you know, this is quite a big topic and a big task. We'd like us to start exploring much more fully a deeper imaginative response to the image of Bodhi. We can take inspiration, we can even take form from the Mahayana tradition. That would be useful to us. But it may not fit into those formal structures. We may not see wisdom with a sword. It may not appear in that way. That may not appeal to us. So he wants us to sort of start exploring much more fully, much more deeply, how it works for us. Again, I want to stress, if you're getting on fine with your own particular visualization practice, that perhaps even getting on fine with it in the way that you were originally taught it, there's absolutely no problem with that. But he thinks that we need to move into a new phase where we are much more helping each other, helping those who are newly ordained, to discover how Bodhi appears in their imaginations. And that's quite a skilled task. And as a preceptor, I feel I'm going to have to do a lot more exploration myself. Fortunately, I picked up some things that Bhante said in 1994. And I've been working a bit in this way myself. In 94, he said a bit what he's saying now, but clearly thought that perhaps the time wasn't completely ripe for it. And it was on the basis of what he said then that the sadhanas were revised. To my mind, they ended up revised. It's a halfway house, so that you simply get sort of slimmed down versions of the originals, which is perhaps a good thing. But what he's initially suggesting was something much, much freer, so that there would be much more of a sense of finding out what appealed, what struck. So this time he was saying, well, you'd really have to ask somebody, look, you're now committing yourself, or you have committed yourself to the three jewels. You've taken on an ideal. So how does that ideal appear for you? How does that ideal present itself to you? Not conceptually, although there may be a conceptual content. It may be that it's wisdom, for instance. It may be compassion. That may be fairly clear and straightforward. Or you may simply be able to say, well, it's the image of Shakyamuni that appeals. It's the image of Tara that strongly embodies my own imaginative connection, thank you. Yes, that may be natural to you, but it may not. And it may require a great deal more sensitive exploration of what's going on inside and of, what is a genuine response, what is a relatively superficial response. It's a very, very interesting area, which I don't know that we're literate enough, imaginatively literate enough yet, but I think Bhante seems to be wanting us to to really have a go at it. Perhaps it's part of his, another codicil to his last will and testament. I think there'll be many more. There's an area where he doesn't want to leave us with a sense that we're sort of a bastard Tibetan organisation in this respect. And that we can take much more radical steps, inspired by what has happened in the Tibetan tradition as it represents that imaginative world, inspired by the images in other aspects of the tradition, Chinese Buddhism, Japanese Buddhism, and so forth. But finding it out much more de novo from ourselves, because we do not live in a world where we take for granted the personification of the world. We're not able so easily to enter into that sense of the world as a living world. So there needs to be a deeper, more exploratory journey of discovery. So maybe I'm sure that I've provoked some questions. Yeah, Prinandas.
It has to do with the refuge tree practice, the tree right in the tree practice. And, well, back in the mid-70s, late-70s, there were two practices that Mitrids did, the stupa visualization and the Shakyamuni visualization practice. I can remember clearly, these were, it was expected that we would do with practice, have a familiarity with them. And, now somebody, men and women of advanced ordination, they do this very complex refuge tree practice, some of which, or most of which, I wonder if they relate to. So, isn't there a good reason to sort of look again at the Shakyamuni practice and look again at the refuge tree practice and see it as, or perhaps it's just visualizing the Buddha and taking refuge in him?
It may be, I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with what's happening. But that would certainly be an important sort of discussion that would have to take place. An investigation of what... one of the things I'm very interested in happening is a kind of almost a survey. What actually is happening? So what are you right? Is it a difficulty for people? And in what way? And in what way is that being handled, and in what way could we do it differently? So it seems to me that we're actually at a point where we've got a huge amount of experience. I've been doing visualization practices on and off since I was ordained in 1973. And I've been through many twists and turns in the course of that. I don't know, here, there are, of course, much, much shorter periods than me, but there's a lot of experience. And some people have much more intense experience than I have. So what are we actually finding? I think we're probably in a position to draw out from what we're actually doing some general principles, even some general practices. Because when I talk to people, I find that very few who've been meditating for quite a long time are doing it in the way that they were taught it. I'm certainly not. So what are we doing? We're doing it because presumably we gain some confidence in our own spiritual momentum, and we quietly follow that up and hope nobody notices. There are no windows in men's souls. So I don't know whether you maybe know more than I do, and it may be that what you say is true, and I'd like to find out. I'd like us to find out, and to look at what is happening.
Well, at the very least, I mean, it would speak that perhaps the, just visualising Shakyamuni and doing the going for refuge and prostration practice with that. Right?
I don't know. It may. I certainly when I was introducing that practice, I used to start people off just doing the Shakyamuni visualising, just seeing a sort of, well, Bhante said a cloud. You see a sort of cloud of figures, but you don't necessarily give them any form. Anyway, yes, I agree with you that, at least to the extent that we need to find out and work out what's best. I've got a little bit more to say on that, which is I think that We need to be introducing the figure of Shakyamuni much, much earlier. Really, I think we need to be introducing at beginner's level, not as a visualization. And I don't really know quite how. But I think we need to be bringing people into contact with the Buddha and talking about the Buddha in a much more living way. I really don't know quite what I mean, but it's almost as if we need to be talking about the Buddha on familiar terms, as if, you know, he's there for us, so that he's in the imaginative atmosphere around us, which I'm sure that is true for many of us. So I think that needs to come in much, much earlier. And then I think when you introduce refuge trees and so forth, it may be a bit easier. Somebody, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I've understood what you're suggesting, because
I'm not sure.
You're suggesting an emphasis on Shakyamuni, and then on the other, a more sort of personalised discovery of what works for you.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's any dangers in that, in terms of losing a common sort of a commonality, where someone might be inspired by Mickey Mouse sadness.
Yeah.
Practice, or ridiculous.
Well, as I say, I think there needs to be a recognition of the difference between an archetype and an illumined archetype, or an illuminable archetype. And so I'm not suggesting a simple free-for-all. That would be asking for trouble. And, I think probably if you contemplated Mickey Mouse long enough, he would become illumined. But I would suggest not wasting your time trying to see whether that happened and when it happened. So I think there's a middle way to be struck, that you're not merely producing the image from yourself. There needs to be some sort of interaction between your own uplifted imagination and illumination coming from the tradition, if you see what I mean. And that's going to be the tricky area. How do we, as it were, set up that dialogue? So it's not all about, oh, I like this. That would be, yes, asking for trivia. I often find that a sort of, to me, in some cases at least, a fairly shallow identification with gods and goddesses from the Western past. So on the one hand, there needs to be an exploration which does definitely come from you. On the other hand, there needs to be an interaction with something that has already some imaginative life. But that should not be too restrictive, if you see what I mean. So it's as if, for instance, you might find that the image of Tara deeply, deeply appealing. But that doesn't mean that you have to see Tara as green. Doesn't mean that you have to see her in a particular form. So I'm not even quite sure myself what the boundaries are of this discussion, but there's a sort of interaction between something that's coming to you, especially founded, as it were, in Shakyamuni, and something that is coming from you. And the trick is to get the balance right, so that it's sufficiently from you for you to really engage, and sufficiently beyond you, well, for you to go beyond you, and for it to be illuminable.
I'm sure I'm typical of many people, that something has started to happen.
Yes.
And it's got a Tara-ish thing, but it's actually got Leonardo da Vinci's book. Oh. And the form of anything is movement of energy rather than...
Yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
But how do we know that in a way this is pointing
towards Well, of course, the classic answer would be you know because you've contemplated it in the context of shunyata, if you see what I mean. So that you see the blue sky and you contemplate the figure as void yet appearing, appearing yet void. So what that would mean in practice is that the image was deeply connected for you with the way things are as expressed by the Buddha. Yes, so that, that the image becomes for you not merely deeply appealing, but powerfully communicating the way things are. Not, that, of course, rooted in a conceptual understanding, but passing beyond that to a direct sense.
So, that experience I'm just describing is quite strongly linked to the sense of no self.
Yes. Yeah. 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 Of course, you may have to go deeper. I remember Bhante saying that on that task in 81, and fascinating, he said that every Buddha form has a Bodhisattva form and a Deva form. And he said to us, how can you tell the difference? So we gave answers, you know, which were to do with how many lotuses it sat on and what colours it was and all the rest of it. No, it wasn't that. And of course the difference is whether it's illumined or not. In other words, whether it is conveying non-selfhood, if you like, an Atman, Shunyata, whatever you like to call it, Praticca Samuppada. That's the difference. So, and this is, makes my point also about the archetype, doesn't it? The archetype is the Deva form. It's very, very powerful, and it is, in a sense, beyond you, but it is not selfless. It is not communicating non-selfhood. So there's this, and of course the way you check that is you make sure your stage of spiritual rebirth is always done in the context of the stage of spiritual death. So that the system of meditation is your guarantee that your contemplation of the images is illuminable. Because you're contemplating them in the context of spiritual death, of anatman, of selflessness. So you need to be, the classic prescription is that you contemplate the image as itself, shunya, void yet appearing yet void. In the Manjushri Stuti Sadhana it says, thus we integrate in the Maya way that does not obstruct the causally originated semblances while it does not fall into the delusion of I, mine, this, that and the other. So that you do see it, it's really there in the sense that it really appears, but it has no reality beyond that. So that you spend some time considering the figure in that way, and that will deepen the imaginative impact of the image. Do you see?
Well, I do, except that you're talking very image based.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Would then it again read image?
Yeah.
Is as any object of sense, imaginative sense. Yeah.
Moving on from that, how do you then, with that approach, how do you then connect more deeply with the Buddha Shakyamuni?
Well, I think that the first point is that I'm not saying, and I don't think Bhante is saying, that everybody's got to contemplate the Buddha Shakyamuni. But what the first thing one has to understand is the position we're in. The position we're in is that we are here practicing the Dhamma because of the Buddha Shakyamuni. And the Dhamma that we're practicing is the Dhamma that he discovered. And the state that we're trying to achieve is the state that he achieved. The goal that we're aiming at is the goal that he discovered for us. So one needs to sort of understand the literal position that we're in, the historical position that we're in. And one would expect that if one understood that, one would have very strong feelings of gratitude and of respect and reverence. So I think that it's a question of contemplating one's position, understanding one's position, and communicating it. It needs to be communicated in our classes and so forth. It needs to be very strongly communicated. And if you choose to contemplate, if it works for you to contemplate a different image, whether that image is seen or not, then understand that that image comes to you, as it were, through Shakyamuni. It's because of him that you have that image. Do you see what I mean? So in that sense, that image is, in a way, is Shakyamuni. Bhante was saying all these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, in a sense, are Shakyamuni. Because they are the hypostases, was the word he used, the embodiments of his realization. They come imaginatively, because this is the way the imagination works, to have their own life. But they come to you because of him. And so that's the point. You need to understand that. Otherwise, you're floating off, as it were. So this is, again, is where the unity comes in. The unity comes in that we understand our imaginative location, imaginative anchoring in Shakyamuni. And what Bhante said is he imagines that, it's very interesting, he imagines that what will happen is that a number of different new forms and ways of practicing will emerge. So it'll take some time. But different streams and strands will emerge that can then begin to be passed on. Because, you know, you've discovered things about the way Tara appears to you. For instance, she doesn't appear visually, though she seems to have Leonardo's face. But we won't dwell on that paradox, because we're in the realm of imagination and paradoxes are all right. So, you know, you've obviously discovered something that's very, very real for you, very significant for you, and clearly in contact with illumination. So, well, you need to be able, you will begin to talk to people about that and communicate that to them, and that will help them to unfold their own imaginative connection with Bodhi. And of course there needs to be a broad concurrence. I think, as in all issues of concurrence, principally an issue of discussion and common practicing together, but especially of understanding our common inheritance from Shakyamuni and our common honouring of the image of Shakyamuni. As I say, Bhante would really like most people to have a strong anchoring in the image of Shakyamuni. However that's, you know, actually pictured or felt or whatever. But he'd like them to have that. And that's why he feels it's so important that we're developing the Triratna Centre at Bodh Gaya, that it strengthens our literal connection with Shakyamuni. And I think that because of the way the mind works, that when you see the places where the Buddha has been, you feel more contact with him. I know, for instance, I went to the place where the Satipatthana Sutta is supposed to have been preached in Delhi. And very, in some ways, stronger than going to Bodh Gaya. It's more specific content, if you see what I mean. So he suggests that we build into our movement real work to locate ourselves in relation to Shakyamuni, and that I think will then allow us to be somewhat sort of a freer and following our noses in the field of imagination. Something, just by the way, this is a point that I feel that I've been quite widely misunderstood on. One of them. I'm very keen, for instance, on us having some coincidence of right view. But I don't see right view as restrictive. What I see is that if we have a coincidence of understanding of the fundamentals of what right view is, that quite a bit of variety can take place. But unless we have that coincidence on fundamentals, our variety becomes mere separation. So I think that if we coincide on the Buddha, on Shakyamuni Buddha, then, you know, different things can unfold and will unfold. And as long as we keep up dialogue, as long as we keep those related to Shakyamuni, I think that we can remain together. Not forever, but for quite a long time.
I think we're held back by our images of the Buddha being practically always meditating rather than communicating, eating. I don't know.
Interesting. Well, it was certainly a very, very keen issue in India. Dr. Ambedkar himself said that he wanted standing images of the Buddha because he believed that Buddhism was socially quietist and that it had allowed, as it were, quite a bit of social evil. So he wanted the Buddha as presented as active in the world. And that's why Lokamitra and others have created this remarkable standing Buddha image at Nagaloka, which is really very, very remarkable indeed, because Dr. Ambedkar believed that the Buddha was a social revolutionary. So yeah, I take your point, and maybe in other fields too. It would be very good to have images of the Buddha in activity, so that we don't... I think we do too quickly identify the Dhamma with sitting meditation in a quite narrow sense. Something I've been quite interested in about the image of the movement, and even the discourse within the movement. Sometimes it's seen that you're the real Buddhists, the real order members are those who are meditating. Well, there are people I respect very, very highly who don't do that, or don't do that mainly. So, yes, I think that could be one thing that influences us, at least, whether it holds us back. It might be... I need to think whether that's the right way to put it. But the images are powerful. And I think I'm more concerned about the fact that our images are mainly from, especially, Tibetan cultural context. That I think is more significant.
So, just getting on from what you're saying, so when you talk about images and our connection with images, we're not just talking about that connection in sitting meditation. We're talking about a connection, a lifelong connection. You know,
yes.
All the time.
Yeah. Yes. There are a number of different things that occur to me from that. I think that if you develop a strong sense of the Buddha's presence or a Bodhi's presence in your life, it's with you all the time. And that's clearly represented in classic sadhana practice by you taking the blessings into your heart, or the condensed form of the Buddha or Bodhisattva into your heart and going out with them. And Bhante said, don't do that unless you really do it. You know what I mean? Don't do it kind of formulaically, unless you actually do walk around with Manjushri in your heart, as the Manjushri Stuti Sadhana enjoins you to do. So that clearly means that the imaginative connection is a living one. And I think this is why it's significant that you're constantly reminding us that image should not be taken for visual image. Because you can't walk around with a visual image of the Buddha in front of you all the time. You'd bump into things. You need to be walking around with a felt sense of the Buddha, which I do. I don't find it hard to find the Buddha, that's what I call it, there in my experience. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it, I think, is that we can do far more to bring the ritual context of the shrine room to life. Is something I'm much more aware of in India, because people in India have a much stronger sense of the image as alive, the murti in Hinduism, but it translates into Buddhism too. So people can't do certain things in the shrine room. They won't. They'd feel uncomfortable doing it. And, you know, it's often quite awkward. You see a Westerner come and sit, you know, in a sloppy manner, feet pointing at the shrine, and, you know, I can see my Indian friends finding that really odd and even uncomfortable, unpleasant. And I now feel it like that when I'm in India. And actually I find it really difficult coming here and not bowing properly. Apology for a bow that we do here. Whenever I can feel I can get away with it, I just do a proper bow, if you see what I mean. What to me feels like a proper bow. And if the Buddha was in front of me, I wouldn't just go like that. I'd throw myself at his feet. So the whole metaphor of a shrine room is a vihara. Vihara comes from the word viharati, which means to dwell. Who dwells there? The Buddha dwells here. That's the point. And the whole metaphorical setup of a shrine room is that this is where the Buddha lives. And so I'd suggest that we can make far more of this. So much more of a sense that we're caring for the Buddha. You know, this goes to quite strong lengths. It's interesting that, you know, in Hinduism, there's the taking the image out for a walk in the morning and changing the image's clothes and, you know, taking the Mr. Deity and Mrs. Deity and putting them to bed together at night and that sort of thing. That's what happens at Pandampur, isn't it? And yes, obviously a very strong sense of the images as alive. Most archaeologists suggest that I've read this actually originated in Buddhism. That the whole tradition of treating the image as the living presence of the Buddha comes from Buddhism. The images emerged in Hinduism under the influence of Buddhism. So it's said that the Jagannath at Puri, the chariot procession, was originally a procession of the Buddha's tooth. And there's quite solid evidence for this. So, you know, we can't perhaps here go to those lengths. But I think we could develop a stronger sense that we're actually in the Buddha's presence. You know, I the first night I was trying to work out where to sit. And I went and sat up there. And I realized after a while I was feeling very uncomfortable. Because I was above the Buddha. And being a good Indian, I know that that's not proper. It feels wrong. So I think we need to develop those sort of, if you like, ritual sensitivities, which are symbolic sensitivities, which are very highly developed in Indians. You know, my Indian friends, both Dalit and non-Dalit. I remember Buddhapalita telling me, from a non-Dalit background, that you know, he did a lot of Hindu ritual as a youngster. It never meant anything in a spiritual sense, but it was a very strong sort of imaginative and sensitive experience for him, which then easily found expression in Buddhism. So yes, I think that we've got imaginative opportunities for bringing the Buddha to life that we're not sufficiently exploiting or exploring. So I think that one could put much more effort into trying to allow oneself to treat the image as the Buddha, as if the Buddha was there. And of course, if you treat the Buddha as if he was there, he is there.